Good morning. Last weekend saw the wireless dominated by the by-election count. However, the turnout, or lack thereof, was the focus for Cormac O'Hara when he popped into Marion to tee up his programme.
Let me give you one image which will tell it all. In Bishopstown, sculling the spirit knee of one of the most affluent parts of the city of Cork, one ballot box was opened and out tumbled one ballot paper.
And John was telling us about another one. No ballot paper, empty.
They were shaking the box to see where was it.
So, not quite rocking the vote there, but gains for the Green Party, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin. But Fine Gael, well, empty stockings. However, one Fine Gael TD making headlines for all the wrong reasons was Dara Murphy. He had, quite legitimately, drawn his full TD salary of €94,500, plus parliamentary standard allowances totalling €51,600 per annum since taking up his job with the European People's Party in September 2017. Patrick O'Donovan, Minister of State for Finance, Public Expenditure and Reform, came on to the Seán O'Rourke show on Monday, ostensibly to talk about the by-election results. But the interview digressed thus.
I mean, if there are questions here for him to answer, he's the person really...
Okay, there's one big question, though, perhaps, that you can answer. Should he give the money back?
That, to be honest about it, Seán, I think you have questions for him and the others have questions for him. He needs to answer them first.
But you might have an opinion on it.
I don't know. I don't know what he was doing, Seán, to be quite honest.
Well, I'll tell you now, I can read from his statement.
And I don't know what his parliamentary duties were at the time. I don't know what he was doing because, as I said at the start, I have enough to be quite frank about it to mind myself.
Yeah, well, that's a fair point. But you see, there's some basic information that Dara Murphy himself has put out into the public, saying that he attended the required 120 days at Leinster House in 2018 and should achieve the requisite number for 2019 and will make the statutory turn when due. But it's like he clocked in on a majority of days when the House was not sitting and then managed on the same days to be tweeting from various cities or parts of Europe.
And Seán... That's a question you need to put to him, to be honest about it, because, you know, I can't understand, as I said a while ago, I have a huge rural constituency.
I know, but in the meantime, has he brought the party into disrepute?
Well, to be quite honest about it, it doesn't reflect well on any of us. It doesn't reflect well on any...
Why should it reflect in an unwell way on you?
Because
you're not Dara Murphy.
No, I'm not, as I said a while ago. I'll tell you why, because it's a cumulative effect over the last number of weeks. That it's a reflection on politics in general, whether it is fabbing or voting or attending
or buying
or printing.
Printers. No, seriously.
Absolutely.
But you see, the thing about it is, we had it from the Taoiseach last week, Patrick O'Donnell, and we had it on this programme from Heather Humphreys, the Business and Enterprise Minister, on Friday. Oh, the printer. Well, now that's not the government, that's actually the Dáil, and the Dáil is independent.
There is one party
that has more members of the Dáil and the Seanad than any others. It happens to be your party, Fine Gael. So
but
it does have something to do with
together
you.
Today after the weekend, we probably don't. But anyway.
Well, the expenses claimed by Dara Murphy drew the ire of homelessness campaigner Father Peter McVerry. He had written to the Irish Times contrasting the cases of three homeless boys in court charged with petty theft, bottle of orange juice, chocolate bars, two packets of cigarettes, with the expenses legitimately claimed by Dara Murphy. He spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time, and it was the very legitimacy of Dara Murphy's actions that really annoyed Father McVerry.
We had a TD going to the Dáil. He was doing nothing illegal in
what
he was doing.
That's what annoys me. He was doing nothing illegal.
Yeah.
But what he did was morally unacceptable and should be absolutely criticised and condemned by our society. Those three homeless people that I referred to were doing something illegal, but what they were doing was minuscule, was totally morally minuscule compared to what Dara Murphy was doing. We treat different people differently. If you're poor, you get treated with the full rigour of the law for the least little transgression.
And Mary Wilson asked about the cost to the state of the cases for the three homeless boys.
Oh, the first lad was the court case went on for about 6 months. He pleaded not guilty. And the cost of doing that could have put him up in an hotel for the 6 months. Mm. And in the end of that court case, just to raise a little laugh, he was found not guilty because after 6 months, the Garda couldn't produce the empty orange bottle, so the evidence wasn't available. So he was found not guilty. But it's what is acceptable and what is not acceptable in society depends on who you are. If you are poor, things you do are not acceptable, even though they may be very, very very, very minuscule. If you're wealthy and connected, things you do are perfectly acceptable, even though you're depriving the state of a vast, vast amount, more amount of money.
Father Peter McFerry with Mary Wilson on Drive Time. And by Thursday...
Now, the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has said former TD Dara Murphy should pay back the money, he claimed, if it's found that he broke the rules on expenses and claims in Leinster House. The Taoiseach was speaking to reporters in Dublin Castle, where Leo Varadkar said the clerk of the Dáil could carry out an investigation into Mr Murphy, who resigned as a TD yesterday.
Áine Lawler on the News at 1. Writer and actor Phoebe Waller-Bridge spoke to Ryan Tuberty on Friday. Creator of the acclaimed TV series Fleabag and the screenwriter for Killing Eve, Waller-Bridge, well, she's rather a big deal. And this is how Ryan introduced her.
With a mantelpiece now cluttered with Emmys, BAFTAs and every other award of note, Phoebe has just been named the most powerful person in television. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, good morning and welcome to the programme.
Good morning, thank you.
Crikey, the most powerful person in television. Where are you? Is that humbling or heartening or harrowing?
It just sounds like I'm armed, doesn't it?
Sounds like you should be arrested.
Yeah.
Ooh, a bit giddy with the power there. Now, Waller-Bridge's work is incredibly contemporary, but she says she looks to the ancient Greek classics for inspiration.
The saying that I kept repeating to myself and the team, you know, when I was writing it was, go Greek or go home.
Did they all get it? I mean, that's pretty...
They all totally get it. Because it was like, we have to go that big.
Okay.
And even if it's not, it has to feel that epic. And that doesn't mean it has to be, you know, like a cast of 10,000 and massive battle scenes. But if it's, it has to feel that epic for the characters themselves. Mm. And I have to be able to write it on the wall like it is a kind of Greek tragedy. Like there's a man, you know, grappling with his faith, and there's a woman who doesn't believe she can be loved, and then by the end, you know, or decides she never will love or be loved, and by the end she loves somebody she can't have, and you know, it just, it's all got to feel sort of that level of Shakespearean or Greek. And I think that's, as a playwright and as a writer, I think it's our duty to go that epic every time, however small the story is, because I think we want to be taken there as audience members. And it feels so kind of sort of ludicrous saying that about a sitcom, but it's even more important to me that even when you're saying, and it doesn't have to be pretentious, you know, but it's, I think it's just what, where you reach for. And I knew that I wanted to break people's hearts with this series because it's a sitcom, and I was like, that's the last thing you're expecting, is to have your heart broken.
And with her depiction of lusty women behaving badly, Ryan admitted that he was getting himself something of an education.
I was saying to a friend of mine, I said, what do you think of Fleabag? And they said, at last somebody's got women right. And I said, well, then as a man, as a straight man watching Fleabag, it's giving me an insight into you and what you're probably really thinking. Because I'm watching it like a manual.
Good on you.
Yeah, well, I want to learn.
Thanks.
I want to learn.
That's like the best... the best attitude I can imagine. You know, when it first came out, the show first came out, and it was saying it's the filthiest TV show that's been seen in years.
Thank God.
You know, and there's, and also there's loads of nudity in it and everything. And like, weirdly, there was no nudity in it. And that everyone's saying she's extremely promiscuous when actually she sleeps with like three people in across the series. And it's just because she talks so openly and so candidly about sex. And I suppose that dual personality thing that I think women can relate to, and I think a lot of men can as well, but that the front that you have when you go out into the world, which in Fleabag's case is her lipstick and her trench coat and her hair, and when if she looks as though she's together, and then she behaves politely to people, and then there's this other side underneath that lives underneath all of us, which is the bit that hides.
That's what's so interesting about the programme, is that for... since television was created, let alone literature and theatre, We've always had the point of view from just one side of this. And I'm not trying to plumose or ingratiate. I'm just, it's a matter of fact. And now at last, something like this comes along and you go, oh, right. So they're, the women are as bad as us in terms of naughtiness, in terms of what they really think. It's kind of, it's refreshing, it's reassuring, and it's heartening.
Oh, good. Because we've all known that forever.
But they didn't tell us. You kept it to yourselves.
People weren't letting us. Yeah. They weren't letting us say.
They're the patriarchy who didn't want to know.
Oh. Ryan Turberty with Phoebe Waller-Bridge. And another woman dismantling the patriarchy one brick at a time was writer Anne Enright. She spoke to Sean Rocks and Arena about a new book, No Authority, Writings from the Laureate for Irish Fiction, and gender politics, power, and how men read work by women was a theme.
You tell a great story in the third of the lectures, which is Call Yourself George, Gender Representation in the Irish Literary Landscape. A woman called Catherine Nichols and the experience she had when she submitted her book for publication.
This woman had no success with agents, so she decided to call herself George instead and sent out the book, which was suddenly an enormous success. And she found herself, or at least, you know, eight times as successful as she had been statistically speaking.
1 in 25 responses to Catherine Nichols, 1 in 3 responses to George Nichols.
So
same book,
same words, same full stop, same commas. So yeah, I thought, well, if a man writes The Cat Sat on the Mat, clearly that is a very important and solemn statement. And if a woman writes A Cat Sat on the Mat, that is a domestic issue and not very interesting. And how this weight happens, how this weight inheres in exactly the same words, very, very cross-making, really. You can't. She was jealous of her own male persona because he was more successful.
He's a much better writer than she was.
Yeah,
clearly.
Much better writer, clearly, you know.
Indeed. Well, her term as laureate now over, Sean asked Anne Enright about her legacy.
The end of the year, then, I said that part of the legacy that you wanted to be remembered was this idea, there is room for everyone.
Oh, I don't want to be remembered at all. give me a few more years to be remembered.
But I was astonished that you even used the word legacy, because it is always, you know, we're always prodding. Interviewers often do that with older writers.
I took it all very seriously. I took it all as a kind of civic responsibility, which is interesting because my writerly instincts are to get the hell out of the country and ignore what's going on and just write a stupid book. And see how it goes, you know. But I was pulled back and I was stuck to it, and I feel it as a kind of knitting together of something for me personally now.
Well, given that you did take it so seriously and it was this sense of civic responsibility, what do you think that Laureate for Irish Fiction, but the post itself, how important is it? What do you think is its relevance?
What it does is it brings a bit of respect to official respect and decorum to the figure of the writer in Irish society.
Anne Enright as heard on Arena. Cavalcade, Noel Coward, A Life in Music was the lyric feature from Michael McCaffrey on Sunday. The first in a three-part series, it took a look at the early life of a man for whom the term notice box might have been coined.
It was clear from the outset that there was something remarkable about Noel. Less partisan observers found his precocity disturbing, and he seems to have exhibited signs of hyperactivity and of a mild autism, which, in the age of children being seen and not heard, was hardly regarded as admirable. Medical advice was sought, and his doctors diagnosed a brain that was growing too fast for his body. They recommended a complete isolation from other children and from any kind of stimulus, the darkened room treatment, in fact. Now, how much of this was for Noel's sake and how much an exercise in damage limitation to others is hard to tell. Certainly, he had an untypical attitude towards childhood and play. Sent away on holiday at the age of 6, he wrote to Mum, informing her that some boys came over to tea, I put on a long dress and danced for them. History does not record how his captive audience received these delights or how their parents reacted either. But the fact that it seemed to have been for one night only speaks volumes.
Oh, that's kind of brilliant. But this penchant for performance was to be a lifelong habit.
Noel never minded singing for his supper and would, later in life, often sit at the piano for hours on end. Occasionally, he outstayed his welcome, and at one Hollywood party, the hostess was instructed by an irate Frank Sinatra to remove him from the piano at once, together with an interesting suggestion for its future storage, should she fail to do so.
Ouch. But luckily, Noel Coward's talent for wit, whimsy and wordplay is beyond dispute.
You'll pull me across the brink. You've chained me and bound me. No escape now, where's the grape now? When is the funeral going to be? Whenever I stop to think, see nature all round me, then I see how stupidly monogamous I am. A lion in the circumstances wouldn't give a damn. For if there were no lioness, he'd lie down with a lamb. Why not me? Any little bug can bite, any little bee can buzz, any little snail on any little oak can feel a little frail and have a little joke. Any little frog can jump like any little kangaroo, but I can't do anything at all but just love you. Any little duck can quack, any little worm can crawl, any little mole can frolic in the sun and make a little hole and have a little fun. Any little snake can hiss in any little local zoo, but I can't do anything at all but just love you.
How spiffing. Back in a jiffy. Welcome back. Graham Norton was back in Bandon in Cork, and he spoke to Brendan Donoghue on Countrywide about finding love in the small ads of the Farmer's Journal.
I've just ring-fenced one or two. Anyone you're interested in?
There's a sincere male. He's 63. Farming background. He's lost the farm.
Yeah.
that's never a good sign, is it? Yeah. Seeks similar but your man, late 50s to 70s. Well, that's me. I'm in. For friendship, socialising, interests, including walking, countryside, gardening, music, sports, current affairs, social drinker, non-smoker, any region can travel, anything, anywhere. But no sign of romance.
No sign of romance. What about this guy's a little more
romantic, South Tip.
Isn't it amazing? You've
South,
met him.
South Tip already sounds like a euphemism. South Tip, gay male, 30. He's only 37. Does he not have an app?
I know.
Like, you're 37. Get a smartphone. Anyway, what's he doing? Would like to meet male for friendship / relationship. Non-smoker, non-drinker, likes country walks, DVD. Is that like...
I don't know.
Is that films?
Like DVDs?
Or is that some sort of strange...
I don't know.
Now he's laughing at me. Yeah. You don't even know what DVD stands for.
Graham Norton with Brenda Donoghue on Countrywide. Clodagh Dunlop was a 35-year-old police officer when she had a brain stem stroke, and when she woke up, she had locked-in syndrome, leaving her entirely unable to move. Ryan Tuberty asked her to take us back to that very first moment when she came to.
Your eyes open and it's initially surreal. I'm relieved that I'm alive. I query, where am I? Because it's intensive care is like a spaceship, or it's like it's a movie set almost, and you establish where you are. And there was a part of me was relieved that I had been right, that there was something wrong with me, but my body was gripped by pain, and then I became terrified. I wanted to scream out for help, but nothing would move. I couldn't make a sound, and simply it was harrowing. I was more helpless than a newborn baby. I couldn't kick out, I couldn't scream. There were tubes incubating me, breathing for me. My tongue was pressed on my teeth, wires coming from both my arms, and I could hear people talking and walking past, and there was simply nothing that I could do. I felt like an astronaut detached from their spaceship, drifting off into the solar system, screaming out for help in the world beneath me, but no one could hear me and I was alone.
However, her partner Adrian tried to communicate with her.
No one talked to me, everyone was talking over me, but it was when my partner visited me and he looked directly at me and he asked me, Clodagh, are you there? If you are, can you blink once for yes? And that was terrifying because I knew that nothing in my body moved. I had no control over anything. I knew my eyes had been open from I was awake, but I didn't know if I had any control over my eyelids. And that moment I thought, I can't get this wrong. I need to be able to blink. And I remember concentrating really hard to close my eyes and then open them as wide as I could. And I was so relieved whenever my partner told me, you're going to be okay, Clodagh. I knew you were there.
And it was through this small gesture that Clodagh managed to communicate. And through sheer grit and determination, she eventually saw a return to speech. After 7 months in hospital, she came home, and although she hit some low points, her recovery continued. She spoke about the gratitude she now feels for the smallest of things.
Do you know, it has really taught me to appreciate the small things in life.
Sure.
You know, I had no control over my arms, so I couldn't brush my own hair. And now I enjoy, I can do my own hair. I can brush my own teeth. You know, just simply to be able to scratch an itch. I can decide what station I want to listen to on the radio. And I just appreciate my environment so much more. And I would say that I really appreciate Ireland so much more. I went skydiving on my year anniversary from taking the stroke because dinner didn't seem really to be an appropriate thing to mark the occasion. You almost died. And when I got, well, when I was hurtled out of a Cessna plane and was descending down over the province, I was like, it blew me away just how beautiful the green checkered fields were. And I don't think I fully appreciated how beautiful our country was until I had a stroke.
A remarkable Clodagh Dunlop with Ryan on Wednesday. Talking to Strangers, What We Should Know About the People We Don't Know is the new book from Malcolm Gladwell. It's essentially about trust. And while acknowledging that sometimes people are bad, sometimes very bad, mostly our intentions are pretty good. He spoke to Sean O'Rourke, who, as a hard-nosed hack and perhaps hardwired for suspicion, was struggling a little bit with this concept.
Like, are you saying that we should just take everybody at face value, and if sometimes we're wrong, as you were saying at the start, well, that's life?
I think that is the right position. Because the number of people who are Hitlers or Bernie Madoffs is vanishingly small. And the benefits of being trusting, implicitly trusting, are so large that we can afford to pay the occasional price of being deceived. I mean, how many times have you ever had a guest on your radio show who was not who they said they were, right? Has it ever happened?
I can't say. I can't recall. I could name a few who promised to come on the show on the basis of a firm handshake and then it didn't materialise or weren't available when we went looking for them and that kind of thing.
But your career has not been derailed by the fact that you trust your guests, has it? I mean, and in fact, the fact that you do enjoy what you do and trust the people who come in is what makes the show work. Well, that's true of all of us, there are other
presenters who would have made a career, Malcolm, out of saying or taking the view of virtually all their interviewees, who is this bastard? And why is he lying to me?
Yeah. Do you think those people last a long time in the media? I don't know. I think they and they pay a terrible price of being disliked. I mean, who wants to go home at night thinking that everyone thinks that they're obnoxious and unpleasant?
So is this really leading up to the conclusion finally that, look, you know, there's good in everybody. Occasionally it doesn't maybe surface to the top and don't take it too personally if you're wrong in the way you judge people.
Yeah. A suitably sceptical Sean O'Rourke talking to Malcolm Gladwell on Tuesday. This year shows record levels of homelessness, with 10,500 people without a place to call home. Against the backdrop of a vote of no confidence in the Minister for Housing, Owen Murphy, a vote he survived, the stories of people who are homeless and the difficulties they face on a day-to-day basis were told across many programmes this week. Philip Boucher-Hayes was sitting in for Joe on Monday's Liveline, and he spoke to Lar, a taxi driver who was at the Grand Canal in Dublin and had seen something that had shocked him.
I'm dropping this guy off from the airport, bring his bag up to the door. I turn and I look and I see these two vans arriving, two small Dublin Corporation vans, the minivans. And I couldn't believe what he's saying. Two of them got out high-vis. One looked like he was some kind of an official. He hadn't got a high-vis jacket on him. He was dressed all in black. He walked down, he just pulled the tent up, grabbed the sleeping bag and just dragged them along the path, just threw them into the bin lorry or the bin vans. The same happened to the other two.
And this was a Dublin City Council bin van, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was clearly marked as such, yeah?
Clearly marked. The ones that you see normally going around with that they have the key where they open the small bins along the street, those vans. These were definitely Dublin Corporation vans.
And these are, as you say, tents that have been there a long time. Fellas who have, for whatever reason, chosen not to engage in the services of a hostel but have decided to sleep out. I know the tents that you're talking about, the way that you describe them actually brings a snapshot of them straight back into my memory. And did you overhear any conversation? Did you get any idea of what they were doing?
I should have actually videoed it, to be honest with you, Philip. I should have videoed it. But I actually said to the guy, I said, look, that's actually somebody's home. And he just looked at me and kept walked on. Just didn't pay any attention to it whatsoever. I was really shocked to think that the Dublin City Council are actually supposed to be avoiding places for these people.
Could you see, Lauren, the way that the tent was lifted up, that there was actually stuff in it, that it wasn't empty?
Yeah. There was definitely stuff in those tents.
And the next night, Lara passed a white van giving out food to people in need, and he happened to meet the man who'd owned that tent.
It was funny because the following evening, I just pulled in, and it was actually people that was giving out, whether it was the Simon or one of the homeless charities giving out a sandwich and a cup of tea. And there was a guy standing there, I didn't even take him for being homeless. And he actually said to me, all my possessions was in that tent.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
How did you strike up a conversation with him? Did you tell him?
I just walked up and I just seen the van and I just slowly walked up. He was standing there. There was a man in a high-vis jacket. He had a sort of a greyish beard. And there was an African guy. He was actually standing inside the van handing out this guy a sandwich.
And you said, you'll never guess what I saw happen here last night.
And I just said it to him. I just said, look, you're probably wondering what happened to the tents. And he says, did you see Anne? And he says, was it vandals? I said, no, it wasn't vandals. It was Dublin Corporation. He says, you're joking. And I said, no, I'm not.
And what was he doing for somewhere to rest his head that night?
He was sleeping rough. He'd nothing. Only for those people had came along and gave him another sleeping bag. He had nothing.
And this tent clearing would seem to be official policy.
From the councils or the corporation or the housing ministers, all the way down the line, that's the way it seems to be. If there's rubbish there, treat it as rubbish. If it looks like rubbish, treat it as rubbish. If it's somebody's tent, just pick it up and throw it in the bin.
And what you saw, Laura, was there was...
worry about some poor unfortunate sleeping rough.
Liveline on Monday. On Wednesday's drive time, Della Kilroy visited the charity Inner City Helping Homeless and heard from one mother living in a B&B who was receiving a food hamper. She has a daughter in primary school and a son with autism who needs to keep his medication in a fridge.
We left quite suddenly. It was very dangerous for us to stay where we were. It was completely unexpected. So it was completely rug ripped out and I grabbed uniforms and books and that was it.
You're in a B&B at the moment, having done night to nights in different places. How long have you been in this situation?
Since the end of August, start of September. Life right now, we're all in the same room and our whole lives are kind of in that room. And we just share everything. I mean, to the kids, it's new to them. So they're in school every day, apart from hospital appointments. It's a nightmare logistically and mentally, physically, on both kids to get to school. We get the bus and then the Lewis and then another bus out to their school. So yeah, it's like dark mornings, and our situation is kind of seeping over into school life. Now we're on the rollover in the B&B, and it's like the big thing was just getting the use of a microwave.
How are your son and daughter coping with living in the one room?
They're not really coping. I mean, you could say on the surface, but the kids don't see me carrying like everything we own from one place to another place, and it just gets harder.
What will Christmas look like for you in the B&B?
I haven't brought myself mentally to even go there. I can't even go there. Like, I miss having my tea towel on my shoulder and cooking, and for me it's just going to seem like I'm a failure, that they're not getting what they should.
A mother and her two children who are homeless, as heard on Wednesday's drive time. And one of the most moving stories this week was on Tuesday's Liveline, when Carol Connors talked to Joe about her 30-year-old daughter Anne-Marie, who had died in homeless accommodation last April. She'd become depressed after her son was born and diagnosed with autism, and this led to her taking drugs, and she'd been homeless since September 2015. She'd moved between various B&Bs and supported housing. And her mother, Carol, described the grinding, day-to-day struggles she had to deal with crossing Dublin City to get her children to school.
She was never out the far side of the city in her life, you know, that way. It was alien to her, and she'd no contacts out there, didn't know anybody, and she had to be at the bus stop at 7:15. Yeah. I remember trying to figure out like which was the best bus route, or whether to get the Dart to Blackrock and get the 114 up, and trying to figure out that with her. And as I said, she started staying up all night then because she was missing the bus, because if she didn't get the 6:45 bus to get her down to O'Connell Street and then from there to get the next bus. And she'd be pushing the little one in a pram because she was only, I think, 4 at the time. So, and then the little lad be running along beside her wanting to go into shops for this, that and the other. And it was just stressful for her trying to get through town with them that hour of the morning. And
yeah, I know. Of course
get
it
to
is.
The school.
Now, Anne-Marie and her two children did get into supported accommodation, which made that journey easier. But the rules of that accommodation meant she was not allowed any visitors at all.
Like, one day the little lad forgot his school bag. We had collected him from school, and then he forgot to... jumped out of the car and in, and we sat outside because we knew we weren't allowed in, waiting for someone to come out and get their attention to give them the school bag. And after about 10 minutes or 15 minutes, I said to my husband, "This is ridiculous, I'm bringing in the bag." Like, he needed it for school. And we went in, and she was standing putting money in her electricity meter. And she looked desperate looking, and just as I had handed her the school bag, one of the workers came out and said, looked shocked to see me in the hall. Now, her door was literally inside the front door, and I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, I know I'm not allowed in." I said, "But he forgot his school bag, he needs it for the morning." And she said, "Oh, you're Annie's mammy." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Oh, we just need to know who's in the building." And that was okay, I left, and as I was driving, getting into the car, drive off, the little lad ran out, "Nanny, nanny, quick, the woman's giving out to mammy of you being here." And I reversed back and I just said, "Do you want me to go in and maybe explain it a bit better, like what happened?" She said, "I don't care anymore, I don't care. Let them mark me off, let me throw me out, I don't care, I can't cope anymore, I don't care." And that was kind of a few months before she died, maybe.
And it was to be a combination of factors that would lead to Anne-Marie's deterioration.
She was a perfect storm, like, of everything that's wrong in this country. A child with disabilities, mental health, an addiction then coming in on top of it, trying to get a diagnosis for her son, trying special schools, no places for him, then homeless on top of that. It was just, it was more than some people can bear, just dealing with one of the things, you know.
And she fell through all the cracks, it seems.
She fell through all the cracks, yeah. But as she was walking out the door that day when I said, "You need to go to hospital," I said, hold on, Annie, I said, "Do you get a house soon?" And she said, I said, "They're giving out, I think there was houses getting built in Ballyogan or somewhere."
Okay.
And I said, "There's houses getting ready in 2 weeks." And she said, "I won't be here in 2 weeks."
She was to be found dead of a drug overdose on April the 18th, 2018. Her two children were with her when she died.
They had been out to McDonald's and came back home to the homeless accommodation, and she gave them a bit of supper then again and went into the bathroom, and they went in, and I think she'd already passed away from what the little one says. John doesn't talk about it. Mm. But she said she needed to go to the toilet and she couldn't. And so we went out and Brood fell asleep under the table, and then he was on the sofa and I fell asleep. And they seemed to, from what she's saying, have wandered around the room all night not knowing what to do. And then she went in the next morning and she said, "We felt Mama," and she said she was like ice cubes. And she said, Brood's mammy's dead."
Carol Connor is talking about the death of her daughter, Anne-Marie Connors, on Liveline. Welcome back. As we hurtle towards Christmas, many bemoan the lack of a spiritual element to the season. However, you can indeed combine your love of a good old shop with some proper penitence, as demonstrated here by Áine Lawler on Thursday's News at One.
Now, 20 priests are going to be available to hear confession at the Sky Court Shopping Centre in County Kildare tomorrow. And on the line to tell us more about all of this is Father Shannon in Claire, sorry, my editor's in my ear and cans, and I don't know what I got wrong, but whatever I got wrong, I'm very sorry. And Father Arnold Rosny, parish priest with St. Sennan's Parish in Shannon, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Anya.
I think I need to go to confession to start this
interview.
You
may need to go now, absolutely.
So listen, tell us about this initiative tomorrow.
Basically, it stemmed from 2015 when Pope Francis declared a year of mercy, and he's quite known as a Pope of Mercy. So we decided, with the invitation from the Pope, basically, to go out and to bring the sacrament of reconciliation to the community, rather than have them come to the church or to a sacred building or a sacred place, that we have got ourselves to where they were at, and no better place than a shopping centre in just before Christmas. And I have to say now, we're doing this, this is our fifth year, and I haven't heard of one negative comment on it yet.
It's kind of God and mammon working together rather well, isn't
very,
it?
Very much so. And if I could use the phrase, business is very brisk with us.
All right. My apologies. I'm looking for absolution on the Shannon
you
there for,
it,
from you
kindly.
Before I go. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Sonia. Bye-bye.
Go in peace, Sonia. All is forgiven. And another sinner looking for absolution was Ray Darcy. Tasked with making a U-log in a bake-off against rugby player Dunica O'Callaghan, he had gone rogue.
Oh, yes.
This is my confession, Emery.
Oh, that's fine.
No, I used Nigella Lawson's recipe.
Oh, that's fine.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. What hope do I have? What hope
Emery,
do
I
have?
Stuck,
there you go.
I stuck to yours, just saying.
The other thing.
I have everything that Nigella's got as well.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me. Say it to Darcy there.
It was a whole family affair because I saw you sent me a picture the sponge was in the baking tray and you had whatever else. So it looked like it was. But you could have got that picture anywhere.
Yeah. No, to be fair, the O'Callaghans got involved. There's actually two missing pieces of Lego that I think might actually be in there as well. Jake O'Callaghan is missing. Yeah, so there could be a crayon as well. So added a little bit to it. But it was good fun.
And the moment of truth is adjudicated by Anne-Marie Dunn.
Yours has fresh cream in the middle, does it?
Yes.
Is that fresh cream? Yeah. Oh,
yours?
Looks delicious. Oh, look at that.
Perfectly formed.
Good cut.
Yeah, good cut.
We'll cut at the same end.
Oh, it's just falling away in your hand. It's really missing.
Oh, look at that too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. I think Nigella hasn't got a clue compared to your recipe.
That's not
fair.
Can I just say for people not watching on telly that Donegal Collins just put his arm around the judge? That's surely.
I wasn't the one that said I didn't follow your recipe.
I know. But she would have known when she saw there was no fresh cream in it.
Basically like slagging the ref. 2 minutes before kickoff. What do you like?
Very nice.
Needless to say, Ray lost. Now, seagulls and herring gulls get a bad rap. The smash-and-grab bully boys of the sky, they're often tarred as the hoodlums of the bird world. And when Dublin listener and eyewitness Carl Ryan got in touch with Mooney Goes Wild, I'm afraid he did nothing to repair their reputation.
Yeah, well, I was walking along. I seen a seagull attacking a pigeon in the sky, and I quickly got my phone out. The pigeon had dropped to the floor, and the seagull started attacking it. I saw the seagull really, really going to town on the pigeon and eating the pigeon.
Eating it.
And taking, eating every organ, I'd say, the pigeon had in its tiny body, but sure. Yeah.
Now, I've seen the video, and the one thing that I'm amazed at, and I suppose most people are too, is the size of the gull beside the pigeon. It's huge.
It's huge. It's completely, like, when you see them fly in the sky, you say, yeah, he's big and the pigeon is normal, but when you see them on the ground and in such fashion of the way I've saw it, it was towering over the pigeon. The pigeon looked tiny towards it. Yeah. You know, it was really incredible, but he devoured it.
Yummy. However, for Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland, the gull was simply, well, being a gull.
I have seen herring gulls, because that's the species in question. It's a herring gull. I have seen them attack and kill other things. I've seen them kill puffins. I've actually seen them actually hunt ducks as well. Right. So they're opportunists. When they see an opportunity for food, they'll take it. So they'll often scavenge things they find in the streets. They'll sometimes catch fish. They'll go along beaches. They eat rats and mice. And if they get a chance to get a pigeon, they will. It's, you know, it would be a difficult thing for them to do. So this particular gull seems to become quite specialised in this, because as you can see from the video, it actually is taken out from the sky. The pigeon's injured there on the street, and then the gull comes in and finishes it off. And of course, that's the way nature is. There's nothing right or wrong about that. It's just, you know, there's no judgment there. It's just the way the birds behave. The animals kill other animals.
Ooh, a sanguine Nile Hatch, as heard on Mooney Goes Wild. And you can check out that video online if you have the stomach for it. The crisis in our beef industry continues, and tensions were high this week when the Irish Farmers Association protested with a blockade outside the Aldi distribution centre in Naas, County Kildare.
Within the past half an hour, there were 10 scenes when one of the truck drivers approached the blockade. He drove at the blockade and said he wanted to get in. He was trying to do a day's work. His name is Johnny Gilbert.
I'm here to the story now.
Yeah, we're there. Like, there's a look. How many lorries have parked up? This is, come on. See, that's the problem all the time. They walk away.
There's nobody going to walk away from
you. There's 3 years are in your back of me. There's one of them off walking over there.
There's nobody going to be bullied here.
You are bullying us.
We're stopping.
So, hold on. Yeah. I haven't got the right to go do me there as well.
No.
Why not?
Unfortunately, you haven't.
All joking aside, have you not battled to be mining at home?
Oh, we have, but what's the point in mining when we're getting robbed in the factory?
You might be getting robbed in the factory, but you're not robbing your money.
I know you're not, and you're unfortunately caught in the middle.
Yeah, but I don't want to be caught in the middle. I have a day's work to do.
Yeah, we all have work to do. People say they're not the problem either.
Yeah, but hold on, right? You're going to let cars in. They can go do their day's work. They can get their day's pay. No, you can't. No, see, look, that's why you are all stand here. Because when someone says anything, you turn your back.
I had seemed to be up to about five minutes ago.
I'm
trying to tell you, you're not going in. All right?
How long are you going to stay here? What about those ways that are empty? What are they meant to do? So you're meant to try, just because the views are struggling, does it mean that everyone else has to struggle?
You'll get your week's wages at the end of the day.
I won't get any week's wages.
We're on our knees.
Well, but you just need to lift this blockade.
They're not going to go for 12 hours, they say. What do you say to that?
They say they'll have to. Like, there's... How many lorries are they? The haulage industry is bad as farming. It's on a knife edge the whole time. Guys are cutting rates on top of each other, left, right and centre. And so you're stopping us from getting paid.
Agriculture and Consumer Affairs correspondent Fran McNulty on Thursday's Morning Ireland down at that beef protest in County Kildare. Dublin's GAA supporters turned a paler shade of blue when Jim Gavin announced he was stepping down as manager of the five-in-a-row team. To say that this came as a bit of a shock is something of an understatement, not least for GAA correspondent Brian Carthy.
Many managerial careers end in disappointment and disillusionment, but aviator Gavin is going out on a high. Did you see it coming?
No, it certainly came as a surprise, as you said earlier, out of the blue, really. It had been expected that he would remain on for another year at least. Then on Saturday morning, he met the CEO, John Costolo, informed him that he was handing back the reins of the Dublin football team to the county committee. That was really Jim Gavin-like. His record, quite incredible, guided Dublin to 6 All-Ireland senior titles, including that historic 5 in a row. He was the leader. His directions were always crystal clear. No ambiguity as to who was in charge. That was important always as a leader. Always a principled approach, military precision, and he never looked for credit for his remarkable success. And let's put it this way, hard to replace.
Ooh, indeed. But hark. What's that I hear? The sound of little Mayo hands clapping in gleeful anticipation? Director of the Gate Theatre in Dublin, Selena Cartmell, was John Kelly's guest on Sunday. Responsible for bringing productions like The Great Gatsby and The Snapper to Gate audiences, you would think her musical choices would be, well, rather on the fashionable side, edgy even, the musical equivalent of a strong red lipstick. But this was her first choice. And just listen closely to John Kelly shudder.
Your first musical choice. And I'm going to go to get a coffee during this one. It was bound to happen at some point. And it's you, Selena.
Mm-hmm.
You're the one. Can you introduce it?
Because I'm will. Sure I'm proud. I will. I'm proud to introduce it as Making Your Mind Up, Bucks Fizz.
You gotta speed it up, and then you gotta slow it down. Cause if you believe that a love can hit the top, you gotta play around. But soon you will find that there comes a time for making.
Thank you.
So, Selena, thanks very much for coming in. We'll see you next week. That's it's Buck's face. And that was, you won the Eurovision that year.
That's correct.
Yeah. Anyway, and to think that you're now running a national institution in this country, it's a shame.
Well, there's room for everyone.
There is.
Yeah, not so much. An unashamed Selena Cartmell lowering standards on Sunday night's Mystery Train with John Kelly, who had to play a lot of freeform jazz after that to regain his cool. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.